Are we okay?
Good. All right, welcome everyone. Glad to have you with us. Glad to have everyone on the right side. Now as Reed moves over. of course, on your perspective, you're on the left, and there's the scripture for that, but we'll do that on another day. Genesis chapter 11 is where we're going to be studying this wonderful evening. I have to share with you while we're turning over here. This may sound odd when I say it, because it sounds odd thinking it. Mississippi, as a rule, smells really good this time of year, just outside. Florida has its own thing, and it's good, but just this is a very pleasant place to be outside. Unless your allergies are kicking off, and then it's not. Genesis chapter 11, beginning there, we're actually going to begin in verse 10. Because as we left off on our study last week, we got sort of to the end of the Tower of Babel account, verse 9 there, and then sort of just kind of ran out of time. But I didn't want to devote the entire class period to verses 10 through 26, because as you read those, what's found between those two verses? A genealogy, okay? And it's kind of like when you begin a study of Matthew chapter 1. You could spend the whole class just on the genealogy and the names. I do, however, want to point out some things that are in this list. Genesis 11 and verse 10, who does the genealogy start with and how does it start? Because that's important. Okay, it's talking about Shem. Uses a very specific phrase for Shem, though. It just doesn't say, you know, Shem was this or that. What does it say? Okay, so it tells us age, and it starts with, these are the generations of Shem. Why is that phrase important? Right, that's one of our 10 divisions in the book. Okay, Genesis has how many books, or how many divisions?
Ten,
all right? One book, 10 divisions, okay? And it's broken into parts. These are the generations of, and then fill in the blank, okay? Here in verse 10, we have number 5, okay? Because I wrote it in my Bible, so I wouldn't forget it. Break up number 5, okay? The 4 leading up to that, we had the generations of the earth, followed by the generations of who?
Adam,
okay? Then the generations of Noah, great. And then generations of, the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, okay? And then here's our 5th one, the generations of Shem. Now, this genealogy does exactly what the last one did, okay? When you go back to that last genealogy, glance over there, if you would, chapter 5. The genealogy found in chapter 5 does a couple of things. It gives us a sense of the time, okay, which is not really even the important point. The genealogy in chapter 5 takes us from Adam to who? Noah, okay? And the one that's found in chapter 5 is not a family tree where you have all of the branches named, right? Instead, it's more like a funnel. We are funneling down to one particular person. From Adam, it spreads out, and then we work our way in to finally we get to Noah and then his 3 sons. In Genesis 11, the same thing happens. Do you notice that? Okay, it starts with the generations of Shem. Shem had plenty of children. You can read those, okay, over in the last chapter. But we funnel down to which child? Arpakshad or Arphaxad, however you pronounce that, okay? Down to one, okay? And then we have other sons and daughters. We're not told about them. Same thing happens with Arphaxad. He fathers Shelah or Shelah, okay? Other sons and daughters, whatever. Continually, we're going closer and closer and closer and closer, okay? We're following one line of people. Who is the destination? Of this list, Terah. And Terah is important because Abraham's important, okay? Terah is the father of Abraham. Or really is the father of Abram. We're not even to Abraham yet. We learn that story a little further along. This genealogy does what the last one did. It takes us from one person to another. It takes us, instead of from Adam to Noah, it takes us from Noah's son Shem to Terah, the father of Abram. Okay. There are some other similarities in this list. You notice that a certain person lives a certain number of years. They father a child. They live after that so many years, they have other sons and daughters. That's a pattern that gets repeated. What do you notice is changing in the list as you go down? The ages. The ages are quickly being pared down to something more like our time. Okay, now 200 is not like our time, but it's a whole lot closer than 950. Okay, and then by the time we get to Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, people are living relatively long, but lives closer to ours. Okay, Jacob even making the comment he didn't live as long as his father Isaac and so forth. There's another big difference in this genealogy and the last one. In what is said here. What was that common sort of negative thing that kept getting repeated in chapter 5? And he died. After every single one. And he died. And he died. All except for Enoch, of course. And he died. And he died. What about this one? Had sons and daughters, but no reference to death. Okay. Now, this doesn't mean they live forever, obviously. The point is different. Okay. Mankind has gotten themselves into a bad situation. Chapter 10, right? So bad that the Lord had to break them apart by languages and separate them and scatter them over the face of the whole earth. Things are not looking good the last time we leave the human race. This list of people is the beginning of the solution, isn't it? Because the solution to the world's problems comes through who? The Messiah, eventually. The Messiah is going to come from the line of Abraham, right? So we have here kind of the start of another cycle, right? We have creation, we have the world being corrupted, we have judgment, and then with Noah we have the world being restarted again, right? And then we have corruption, we have judgment, Tower of Babel. Now here we have the beginning of the solution. Okay, the solution is going to come through Abraham's line, and this genealogy brings us to that. Perhaps a reason why death is not emphasized here, as it was in chapter 5. It's true that they die, but that's not the point. The point is to get us to Abram, because it's in Abram that we're going to have some hope. Any other things you notice about the list found there in chapter 11? Any other things that stood out to you? Know that we have a certainty that they're firstborn. It seems to be written that way. You know, they lived after they had fathered so and so a certain number of years, but whether those other sons and daughters are born before or after, I'm not certain. Some people think yes, just because of how it's worded, but I don't know that we can be certain. Yeah. As far as, so I with him, it's probably a safe bet. Okay, it was more than likely pretty close to after that. All right. Anything else from the genealogy other than the names that are, although I'll give you this, the names in this one aren't bad. You know, they're rather short other than one, maybe not so hard to pronounce. When we get over to the Canaanite and the Eastern kings, those are the ones we want to learn their names because they're really fun to say, one in particular. All right. Genesis 11. Let's go on to verse 17. Verse 27. How does it begin? All right. Another division. The sections in Genesis are not the same size. They're not like chapters where they're roughly the same size. They are given by subject. Okay, the generations of Shem serve only to bring us to Terah and by him Abram. Okay, these are the generations of Terah. The generations of Terah tells the story of Abraham, or Abram, as we're going to know him to begin with. This makes number 6, only 4 left to go. Okay, any guesses who the last 4 are? Who they might be? Think about big people in Genesis. You'd expect Isaac would probably have one. You'd expect Jacob would have one. Maybe Joseph. Okay. Anyone else of really big importance in the book? Abraham has a rather important son that's not Isaac. Ishmael. Ishmael actually gets one too. His is the shortest, oddly. But we're going to get to those. We're not there yet. But expect those as we move forward. These sections tell the stories of particular groups of people And in this section, we're going to be talking about, in particular, Abram, once we arrive at how once we learn where Abram comes from. Begins in chapter 11, beginning in verse 27, telling us there, hopefully, about Terah. Back up. Okay. 11:27. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. Now Sarai was barren. She had no child. Anything in this that is unique, or that is the first time we're hearing about it? Okay, so they're marrying within the family. It's not unheard of. Okay, of course, the first marriages had to be within the family, right? So the prohibition against that sort of thing comes later. Okay, not so much an issue now. They don't marry brother and sister. Abram and Sarai, they have the same father, but not the same mother. Okay, so we're going to hear more about that in the story. It gets them in trouble a couple of times, that difference. What happens here that's going to matter later on in the story with Abram? We know a little bit about Abram. Big people in Abram's life are Sarai, obviously. How does Lot fit in here? Nephew, son of his brother. Okay, his father dies. So naturally he would go live with his brother. Okay, possibly elder brother, depending on if Abram's the firstborn. That's how we have the connection with Lot. That's why if we didn't have chapter 11, we would arrive with Lot later on in the story and wonder, well, why is Lot wandering around with Abram? We get a detail here that helps us understand why Lot is there. Something else here that hasn't been said before in Genesis. Sarah is unable to have children. Okay. That's a very big difference from what we've seen so far. We've had no indication that this happened yet, at least in the book. Now, the people it was written to were familiar with this, obviously. But so far, people are being fruitful and multiplying. Even after the flood, they're fruitful and multiplying. Okay, they're dispersing. The chapter leading up to that, they're having other sons and daughters, and now suddenly we arrive at Sarah, no children. Okay, that's a problem. That's actually the biggest part of the story when it comes to Abram, this relationship based on this child that's going to be born. Abram departs Ur of the Chaldeans, okay, with his father, presumably, to go to Canaan, to go to the Promised Land. Does that sound vaguely like any other part of the Bible story? The Israelites are going to leave Egypt and go to Canaan, okay. Anywhere else Israel comes out of basically Babylon and goes back to Canaan? Yeah, it's after the captivity, right? It's the events leading up to the birth of Christ. Okay, they come out of this area and they go into the land of Canaan. Now we're told here in verse 31, Terah took Abram his son and Lot the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, and his son Abraham's wife, and they went forth together from this place to go to the land of Canaan. But what happens in the middle? They didn't make it, or at least they didn't get all the way there. They come to this place called Haran also. Stay there, and Terah passes away at 205 years. There are some other people in this story that are important. Nahor and Milcah, how are they going to factor in later on with Abram? Okay. Nahor and Milcah are the parents of Bethuel, who is the father of Rebekah. You remember Rebekah marries Isaac in just a few chapters. So the fact that their names pop up here is kind of a signpost. We need to remember that. There is also some irony here. What does Abram's name mean? Did you look that up? Did you find that in your studies? Exalted Father. Why is that ironic? He has no children. Okay. A lot of times, in Genesis, the name matters. Okay, what the name is matters. We're going to read of Melchizedek not long from now. The definition of that name matters. Adam's name mattered. Eve's names all of them matter, right? That's why Abram has his name changed, because it was connected to something in his life. His son is named Isaac because he laughed. You remember when he was told he would have children. The names matter and what they mean matter. And so it's important to see that with Abram. His name means exalted father, and it's ironic because he doesn't have any kids. She is barren. So God is going to have to step in if she's going to be able to have children. That's an important thing moving forward, the fact that God steps into the story. I do want to go to one other passage real quick. Acts the 7th chapter and verse 2. This was actually one of our questions about Terah. We went through this already. The familiar phrase is the generations. This is another breakup in that. Nahor and Milcah are the parents or the grandparents of Rebekah. Okay, through Bethuel, their son. You can find that a little later on in the story. I think it's chapter 22 or 23. The irony behind his name, he has no children, yet he's named Exalted Father. That irony only increases when God changes his name to Abraham, father of many nations, because he still doesn't have kids. But God's going to bring that to pass. The last question here, how does this section agree with Acts 7, 2 through 4? As you turn over there, this is Stephen's retelling of the sort of the events of the Genesis and the Exodus accounts, really, and right before he's stoned. Begins there in verse 2. Brothers and fathers, hear me. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he lived in Haran and said to him, go out from your land and from your kindred and go into the land that I will show you. Then he went out from the land of the Chaldeans and lived in Haran. And after his father died, God removed him from there into this land in which you are now living. How does that square with the events described in chapter 11? Yeah, they're the same. This is what happened, okay? So when we read in chapter 12 that God said to Abram, go out from your country, where was he when he said it? Had to be the previous location. True. A section of it. Okay. Nothing says he was told more than once. Okay. He might have been reminded to do so. Perhaps they're on the way and his father becomes ill and they stop there. Who knows? Okay. But it's important that these two accounts square with each other. I think he was told beforehand. Based on Acts 7. When he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, it said to him, go out from your land and from your kindred. So I think he was told prior to being in that place. It's not a problem with Genesis. Sometimes Genesis, the timelines don't exactly go in the order of the text. Like the Tower of Babel actually happens during the events of chapter 10 in the genealogy, or the list of nations that's there. When and where isn't as important as what in this case. And what was he told beginning there in 12 and verse 1 back in Genesis? 12 and verse 1. What did he say to him? Go. Okay. Where are we headed? Well, we're headed from where I'm at now. Okay. Go from this place. Land that I will show you. Verse 2, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. How important is this section of the book of Genesis? It's up there. This is the beginning of the solution. Okay. And you might say the beginning was maybe the genealogy leading up to Abram. But this is not the first absolute reference to Jesus. I think there are some others. But it's the clearest one so far. Okay, these promises. Now there's something said here. Have we heard about lands and nations and families before? In the text. Bingo. Okay. And even just before that, when the sons Shem, Ham, and Japheth, That's how they're described in their lands and in their families and in their so forth. Okay. So we have them broken up into all these lands, and God decides in 12, I'm going to raise up my own family and land, and they're going to be a blessing to the rest of them. Okay, one author of a commentary I like on this book said this is the central passage of the book. The foundation of the Abrahamic promises, I like that word, Abrahamic, and the beginning of the nation of Israel as a worshiping community. I don't think that's true, but the first part certainly applies. It's the beginning of Israel, but not as a worshiping community. Three promises, the land, the seed, and the blessing of all the families on the earth. Why is that important based on what just happened in chapter 11? This is, like you said, this is the way back. Okay, because of what mankind did, and they were judged at Babel, they've been separated, they've been splintered, they've been broken apart. But in 12 and 3, all the nations are going to be blessed through this. So instead of what they got for their own sins, they're now going to be blessed, all of them, by the family of Abraham. It's how they're going to come back together. God's really going to undo the division that happened at Babel through this family. Yeah, by the time we get there, which is of course way down the line, we're the promise, and the promise comes to us, and no one else benefits. They missed it. Yes, sir.
I was sidetracked, but I had to go back and check this since I just thought about it. When the Israelites are getting this, what's important? Is this the first time that wives are actually specifically mentioned by name? Or do you go back to Noah's wife?
There's Noah's wife. The only other one is Lamech's wife. They're named. It's not a great reference, certainly. But Mrs. Noah, obviously, as we know her, she's not named. Mrs. Shem, Ham, and Japheth, we don't know who they are. But certainly Sarai, it would be one of the only other ones that's named. All of the wives leading up, all the wives after this are named. Even, you know, Hagar, who is of course, I think a big mistake by Abram and Sarai. She is named, but that is a good point, that she is specific to the text. And I think why she's named is the role she plays. God is going to do something impossible through her, so it's important that we know who she is. There's one more thing here. All of the families of the earth. That's an interesting phrase in this book. When we talked about things happening to the earth, okay, Noah's family is the one that's divided, okay, and broken up, really. Noah's sons and their descendants, they're the ones that are busted apart. Through this family, everyone's going to come together. The last time something was pronounced on the whole earth, what was it? Or maybe the first time something was pronounced on the whole earth. The flood, before that, too. There's another one. Because of mankind's sin in Genesis 3, what happens to the earth? Ground is cursed, right? So you sort of see this is almost a reversal of that too. All the families of the earth are going to be blessed rather than cursed. There's some other references we can make back to that. The promises that are made are preceded by a command. What's the command? Go. Get out of here. Leave Ur and go away. All right. What does Abram say in this reference, in this time? Nothing is the best answer. It doesn't say a word, which is important. Someone else in the book of Genesis was told to do something and said nothing but acted. Noah says nothing. until after the flood. Only thing you find with him, God gives him a command, he carries it out. Word for word. The good thing now that we come to Abram, we find him doing the same thing. He's told to leave, he gathers up his stuff, and he leaves. 75 years old, verse 4 tells us, when he departed from Haran, he took Sarai and Lot, all their possessions, and all the people they had gathered, and they set out to go to Canaan. There's a reference to this over in Hebrews 11. I do want to read that with you tonight. Hebrews 11, beginning there in verse 8, the great chapter of faith, you remember that. Abram is, I think maybe, if I remember right, he's the only one in the list mentioned, only one in the chapter mentioned twice. I have to check that again. But if he's not the only one, he's one of two. Hebrews 11, beginning there in verse 8, tells us, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith he went to live in a land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to a city that, to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. Abram's not looking for a place built by men. He's looking for a place built by God, or given to him, established by God. And in Hebrews 11, 8 through 10, you don't see him saying anything there either. He's told what to do and he leaves. It's a good example of that for us. What did Abram have to give up to go? Family. How tough is it to leave family in this day, in the day of Abram? You just didn't do that. Okay. So far in Genesis, being sent away from your family is a curse, isn't it? But in this case, God asked him to leave his family and to go to this land that he doesn't know where he's headed. Does that sound like a command that comes up far later in the Scripture? What did Jesus tell his potential disciples they would have to do? Leave father and mother. Okay? Or whoever loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. Okay? Sometimes this is what is asked of disciples, if necessary, to leave and to oppose their own families. Okay? A little later on in the story, Jacob is going to be opposed to Laban. They're going to be enemies of each other. And it's that contrast between those people of God and the people of the world, even when those people are in our families. Abraham and their company, in verse 7, they arrive in Canaan. God reiterates a small portion of the promise. Verse 7, what does he remind him of? Genesis. To you, offspring, I will give this land. Notice the reference to kids again. To your offspring, I will give the land. There are no offspring yet. That's going to be a continuing thing we have coming up now. Is Abram going to receive the land proper? Like, here it is, it's yours. No. He's going to wander. He's going to sojourn the rest of his life. In fact, when does he actually take possession of a small part of the land? Sarai dies, and he buys a cave in the field along with it from one of the Hittites. And that's really the only part of the land he possesses. It's this little tiny portion where Sarai is buried and where other family members would be buried later on. What's Abram's response to this request in verse 7? Built an altar. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, Noah did the same thing, and in similar circumstances. Noah's given a great promise. And then Noah begins to worship the Lord. It's a similar response. It's good to see this out of Abram. The last time we talked about what mankind did, whose name were they worried about? They're worried about themselves. If you go back to chapter 11 and verse, 4, mankind's trying to make a name for themselves. Contrast, Abram builds an altar and does what? Calls upon the name of the Lord. Okay, verse 8. He's not seeking his own. That's going to be a theme we find from Abram. Now, Abram's not a perfect person. The next story we read from Abram is a bad one. And we read more than one bad story from Abram. But Abram's life begins and it ends, or the story of his life really begins with an episode of faithfulness here, and it ends with one. We have some things in the middle that are back and forth. Let's make sure I didn't run by anything. Okay, why is this section important to the listener or to the reader, the hearer of the book, the first time? Why does this matter to them? Okay, what are they getting ready to do? Israel. Yeah. They're in the wilderness. They've received this. They're getting ready to really fulfill all of these things. This is really important stuff to them. Part of the promise has already been fulfilled. Which part? The descendants and the great nations. Okay, when Israel, some estimates give Israel being 2 million people coming out of Egypt. Once you count, you know, everybody. And then you can see in the law of the census, okay, that they would take in the wilderness. There's hundreds of thousands of Israelites now. So part of that promise, they are it, right? They are the realization of some of that. And they're getting ready to realize more of it, this land that they are given, that Abram has come to. This is really important to them. It's good to see that. There are other things that are good to see as well. Why is this section important to you and I? Okay, we're on the other side of this, but we can see that God fulfills His promises, least of all, right? Or, you know, that's an important thing. Why do these promises matter to you and I? We're worried about one in particular. We're worried about Jesus. And Jesus is specifically referenced here. It's through Him everyone's going to be blessed. Have this opportunity to have salvation. These promises aren't just, oh, well, that's good for them. These are good for us too. Because they're the way by which we're going to be saved. Okay, this is the way back home, really, for a world that's very broken, and it begins here. What's that? Absolutely. We have hope in a God that promised this thousands of years ago, and it happened in precisely the way He said. You know, in an impossible situation, we have that same hope. Okay, we talked about this a little bit already. What promises were made to Abraham? There were three of them. The land, the seed, and the blessing of all nations. Okay, however you want to remember that, there's probably a different way to do it. They got the land, they got lots of people, and they blessed everyone through their line. That's the line of Christ, through Christ. We've been introduced to that already in the text. Okay, this idea of land and nation and families. You saw that in chapter 10. With the division of the nations right before the Tower of Babel. So it's not a new idea, land, nation, and families. How do His promises seek to repair the damage that sin's brought to the world? How do these promises fix everything that's wrong with the world up to now? Okay. It's through this that we have an answer for sin. Through the blessing of all families, through Jesus Christ. Okay? The world is splintered and broken apart and scattered, and it's through this that we're going to have a nation that can come together. Not just Israel, but a spiritual nation is going to come from this. Okay? A promised land. Okay? A way back to God's good presence, to God's presence. These promises matter a lot. Okay. How did Abraham respond to the promises? First thing he did is he left. Okay, he says, God says go, and he went. Secondly, what did he do the second time the promise came around? Worship. Okay, obedience, worship. You can't go wrong with those two things. And there's the second half. There's the worship. Why is that appropriate? Why appropriate to worship God at this point? It's always appropriate. Why? I think you said the two most important parts of it: thankfulness and praise. Right? God has made some pretty astounding things promised here. Thank Him. Thank you. You know, that doesn't earn you the right to receive them, but at least be grateful and then praise the God that can do those things. That's fundamentally why we worship now.
It does make you think about It is.
And it's a big move for people today to think that they're going to move 1,000 miles away from the family and friends. But we don't move over to a black hole. We just ask to go into a black hole by God. And that takes tremendous faith. And it does, to me, make me think about, you know, the faith of his father, his faith, and how God can establish, or God's dealing with them in such a way to establish such a solid foundation of faith. What the I don't think a faith is miraculous bestowed upon. I think it's a faith that would arrive at through the normal means that we try.
Yeah, there was.
I'm told from a district once that the authors of books speculated that Greg said that they left an herb to go to Canaan, that you had terrorist family in Ur, which history would tell us was a big, thriving city, one of the earliest places that you read about. And what went on there, the kind of government they had. But it probably was not a place where most of the people worshiped God.
Oh, no.
And all of these.
It's definitely not.
All of these people, being the sons of Noah, should have known about God. And that's been several generations that we're likely talking about now, one generation that don't really believe God. And so we had a family who was still trying to follow God, and they decided to leave there. And like Todd said, God says, no, not where you want to go, but where I can.
And it's, and of course, this is what happens when you don't write down your references, but not everyone, even in Abram's family, worshiped God. There were people, they worshiped other gods. Again, I can't find the reference. I'll bring it back for you next time. But you're absolutely right. Not just, here, I'm going to make you some promises and then just, we're just going to rest for a while. We're just going to take it easy for a bit. No, I'm going to give you some promises. Now go live accordingly. You know, go live in this land that I'm going to give you, but not yet. And bless you with children, although your wife can't have any. And there's a lot of faith that has, maybe possibly why Abram's faith is so important to you and I now. Abram's faith is the one that's exemplified in Romans 4 as an example for us to follow. Okay, he's listed, like I said, twice in Hebrews 11. Important things to notice here. All right, before I run out of time, 12 and verse 10 up to 13 and verse 1 is where I think I want to begin next class period. I'm calling it the embarrassing Exodus. Exodus is not just because he leaves Egypt. There are a lot of parallels between the Exodus you and I are familiar with in the book of Exodus and what happens here. And I want you to notice some of those things. Let's begin next time on 12 and verse 10. And then we'll get as far as we can get. If we get into Abram and Lot, which we probably will, we'll go ahead on to that. A couple minutes I have left. If you haven't noticed on the back table, tonight's questions as well as the next section's questions are on the back table. I think it's tan paper this time. I don't remember one of those. So you'll be ready for that. Also, Jerry suggested that I put the specific place in the text we're going to be on our calendar, on our website. I'm going to do that. I'll do that in the morning or when I get to it tomorrow. That way, if you go to our website, you'll know not just what lesson we're on, but what part of it, since we're doing more than one day per lesson. Thank you for your good comments. I appreciate studying with you always. And like I said, verse 10, we'll pick up, Lord willing, next Wednesday.